It's Thursday, October 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, Vice President Biden says he will not run for president.
Unfortunately, I believe we're out of time, the time necessary to mount a winning campaign for the nomination.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton faces questions over her role in the Benghazi affair. Britain and China sign major trade deals and will meet some women who take gaming very seriously. Vice President Joe Biden made it official Wednesday he will not be running for president in 2016. In a Rose Garden speech at the White House, Biden said that he and his family have recovered from the loss of their son, Beau Biden, but the grieving process meant that he could not mount a successful presidential campaign.
As my family and I have worked through the grieving process, I've said all along what I've said time and again to others, that it may very well be that that process, by the time we get through it, closes the window on mounting a realistic campaign for president, that it might close. I've concluded it has closed.
With President Obama and his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, by his side, the vice president said he would continue to work with the president to accomplish the goals that the two men have worked towards during two terms in office.
I believe that President Obama has led this nation from crisis to recovery, and we're now on the cusp of resurgence. Well, I'm proud to have played a part in that. This party, our nation, will be making a tragic mistake if we walk away or attempt to undo the Obama legacy.
Mr. Biden spent much of his speech calling on other leaders to end partisan bickering and gridlock and work together for the good of the country. The vice president said that he and his family found purpose in public service and will continue that work even after the Obama administration is over.
We intend to spend the next 15 months fighting for what we've always cared about, what my family's always cared about, with every ounce of our being, and working alongside the President and members of Congress and our future nominee. I am absolutely certain we are fully capable of accomplishing extraordinary things. We can do this. And when we do, America won't just win the future. We will own the finish line.
Joe Biden spent more than three decades in the U.S. Senate representing the state of Delaware. He had previously launched two unsuccessful presidential campaigns, most recently in 2008. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is the frontrunner for the Democratic Party's nomination for president in 2016. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders runs second in recent opinion polls. The vice president's decision comes at a time when former Secretary Clinton is looking to strengthen her lead in the Democratic field. VOA's political correspondent Jim Malone told us that Wednesday's move is a big relief and a big boost for Clinton's chances at the Oval Office.
There'd been a lot of uncertainty hanging out there with a possible Biden candidacy, a lot more unknown factors were he to get into the race. She already has a strong challenger in Bernie Sanders. But last week, she had a strong debate performance for the Democrats. And in fact, her poll numbers have been bumping up a bit now in the polls. And now without Joe Biden entering the race, it looks like it's going to be a choice between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And the gap is sort of expanding now between the two of them. It doesn't mean it won't change. Doesn't mean that the race won't be still difficult for her in some ways. But I think this is a huge boon for her coming off the debate performance and now Biden's decision not to run.
That's VOA's political correspondent Jim Malone. Turning to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins us in the studio. Hello, G.
Hi, David.
What is the best Twitter handle to follow for Joe Biden's big announcement?
There are two, actually. The Democratic Party manages an account with the handle at Joe Biden, and it sometimes features tweets from the vice president signed Joe at the end of a tweet. And that account hasn't been very active anymore. It used to send out one or two tweets per month, but hasn't tweeted anything since May.
Now, Mr. Biden said that he's going to continue to work with President mm-hmm. Obama to accomplish their goals. So
that's right.
Is there a better account if you want to follow the vice president?
Yes, the account run by the vice president's office is a better one to follow for sure. That handle is @VP, and tweets from Mr. Biden are signed VP at the end of a tweet. But then again, there are no tweets from this account Wednesday.
Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of people waiting to see a tweet from the vice president about his announcement.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And guess who did tweet about the announcement?
My guess is probably his former colleague.
That is correct. The former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, tweeted this. @VP is a good friend and a great man. Today and always inspired by his optimism and commitment to changing the world for the better. Now, something tells me, David, that Biden dropping out of the race made him an even better friend to her than before.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty safe assumption.
Mm-hmm. There are many, actually, and I also wanted to tell you a little bit about the media reaction. There are many analytical pieces about how the recent loss of his son impacted his campaign timeline. And Biden has been seeking presidency for decades, as you know. So Wednesday's decision surprised many people. But on a lighter note, I wanted to end this segment with a list of Biden gaffes. The Politico magazine tweeted a link to a list of dozen Biden blunders, and one of them is this. Look, John McCain's last-minute economic plan does nothing to tackle the number one job facing the middle class. And it happens to be, as Barack says, a three-letter word, jobs, J-O-B-S, jobs. Now, that speech is from 2008, but never gets old, and the best part is that list is titled Jobbing Joe. David?
It definitely is a four-letter word. Well, thank you for that wrap-up, G. You can follow her on Twitter, @GAbbyLee, and she also tweets from our VOA International Edition account. That's @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testifies before the House Select Committee on Benghazi later today. That committee is investigating a September 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that left four Americans, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens, dead. Mrs. Clinton has characterized the committee as an arm of the conservative wing of the Republican Party. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy suggested last month that the committee's investigation has hurt Clinton's presidential bid. VOA reporter and producer Ann Ball has been looking into the story and says that a lot is at stake in this hearing.
This is now the eighth investigation that Congress is conducting into what happened. And so far, there hasn't been any concrete wrongdoing found. Room for improvement, but this committee is going to look at some different angles than others have done.
So what can we expect to come out of this hearing tomorrow? Mrs. Clinton is in the middle of a political campaign, and it has been said by House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy that this committee had an effect on her politics or her political campaign. What can we expect to come out of this now?
It's going to go on for a long time. They say a minimum of 8 hours. And so you know, everybody will be hanging on every word, but she will be grilled by the Republicans over this email controversy. Now, a little bit of background on that. She had, when she was Secretary of State, she conducted all her email, both personal and government email, through a private server. Now, this was not illegal, but it was irregular. And this is what the Republicans on this particular committee have been probing. And the head of the committee, Congressman Trey Gowdy, has said that recently that they found, looking at Ambassador Chris Stevens' emails, that he had been asking repeatedly for more security in Benghazi. So look for some sharp questions from the Republicans about, did you, Mrs. Clinton, do enough to protect those American lives?
Now, what are political pundits saying about this whole circumstance? There are commentators on both the right and the left who have had a lot to say about this. What is some of what you're hearing?
Well, the stakes could be pretty high, depending on how Hillary Clinton does tomorrow. Some people are saying that if she stumbles and falters under the Republican questioning, that this could really hurt her political chances. And there's been a lot of attacks against the Republicans on the committee, and one long-time political observer that I spoke with said that he thought the Republicans need to be very careful because it could backfire if they don't find anything really to stick against her. But she's also, you know, not in the clear at all. So we'll just have to see how it comes down. There are stakes for both sides.
All right, that is reporter and producer Ann Ball. We welcome your comments on this. You can send us a tweet. We are at @VOA_IE. You can also log on to our webpage, voanews.com, and leave your questions or comments there. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Over the past few years, researchers have made tremendous strides in making prosthetic hands more lifelike. While scientists are getting close to making artificial hands perform as well as natural hands, one area that remains a challenge is replicating the sense of touch. Engineers at California's Stanford University answered that challenge and have created a plastic skin that can detect how hard it is being pressed and then produce an electric signal that will provide that sensory response directly to a living brain cell. This new artificial skin will allow users to be able to detect the pressure differences between a light finger tap and a firm handshake. The skin is made with two layers of plastic. The top layer acts as an input device that senses the touch and the intensity of the touch. The bottom layer is like an electronic circuit board that sends electrical signals and converts them into biochemical stimuli that are compatible with nerve cells. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd, reporting from Washington. Britain and China have signed billions of dollars in business deals Wednesday as President Xi Jinping met with Prime Minister David Cameron during the second day of the Chinese leader's state visit to Britain. Speaking to reporters in London after the meeting, Mr. Cameron said that he wanted to make Britain the partner of choice for China.
The more we trade together, the more we have a stake in each other's success, and the more we understand each other, the more that we can work together to confront the problems that face our world today. The stronger the relationship between our countries, the more we'll be able to have a serious dialogue. We may not always agree, but we can discuss issues openly and constructively.
Mr. Cameron said Britain and China were signing a deal to finance a nuclear power station in southwest England, a deal that both countries wanted to take their ties to a new level. The two sides had also discussed the excess of steel globally supplied and reached a new deal on tackling cyber espionage, that is. These days, these deals, that is, come after China announced more bad economic news this week, with a third quarter growth from July through September at the slowest pace in 6 years, coming in at 6.9%. Well, whether you call it ISIS, ISIL, or Daesh, the Islamic State has proven to be adept at recruiting members and targeting adversaries through social media. International Edition's Ira Melman reports on a symposium presented today by VOA and the Newseum in Washington, exploring possible ways to counter Islamic State media.
Two possibilities were detailed by Lorenzo Vedino, who directs the program on extremism at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University.
Basically undermining from a theological point of view, from a personal point of view, the different fallacies in ISIS ideology and theology. The second part is going after ISIS ability to be so good on social media, and that also entails a variety of actions, which are very complicated. I suspect that one of the reasons why we heard earlier from the State Department that we've seen less propaganda coming out over the last few months is because there has been a targeted campaign against some of the top ISIS propaganda people with targeted assassination on the ground in Iraq and Syria.
We've also had this
never-ending debate on whether we should take accounts down or not. Right. There's an intelligence value in keeping them up. Right. At the same time, keeping him up, obviously, as a radicalizing power.
Another of the symposium's panel was Baroness Emma Nicholson of Winterborne, a member of the British House of Lords and chairman of the Amar Charitable Foundation. She says another possibility is to supplement digital media with face-to-face contact, something she was able to do with a small group of Yazidi girls who had been captured by and then escaped from ISIS.
But thanks to everybody's kindness, I and the Amar team managed to bring three young Yazidi victims to London. I had them give evidence in camera to the committee I chair in the House of Lords, which is a committee to prevention of sexual violence in conflict. But even more importantly, perhaps, they made three very small films, little videos, in which they told their stories. And their stories were bad enough on the video, but of course, in reality, they were 1,000 times worse. The real story
was
utterly stomach-churning. Heaven knows how these girls are alive and how they got out at all. And those videos we've managed to take to some of the schools. And we managed with one school to take the young ladies with us to the school, wrapped up their faces, because, of course, with all the social media, ISIL kills or hurts any captive family member that they may have, and they've got family members of almost everybody. So we managed to take them to one of the schools, which in a sense was a source, if you like it, for young people getting excited through social media on ISIL, and maybe even going, because we've lost about 1,000 young people from the United Kingdom. We took the three young ladies, showed a little bit of the video, and I have to say that the young people were stunned, silent, devastated. And then, one by one, two boys got up, one by one, one clearly a Muslim, one I think probably not, and they apologized for the whole male sex for what had happened. And then the girls started to get up. I think there's a reality that is missing in social media. I would suggest it's not so much social media we have to get to, it's actually face-to-face.
In addition, Nicholson said people in areas now occupied by ISIS need access to outside sources of information. You can find more on the symposium at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
Studies show that nearly half of all digital game players are women. But most women play casual games on their smartphones or tablets, unlike many men who like to compete online with other gamers. But as VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports from Los Angeles, while competitive online gaming remains a male-dominated sport, that is slowly changing.
These women love computer games, and they found some competition at an Intel Developers Conference in San Francisco. Diane Tran of Houston, Texas, is part of a team of women gamers called CLG Red, part of the Counter Logic Gaming Esports organization.
We've come so far with gaming and women in its female scene, and it's growing bigger and bigger each day.
Members of Trans Team play online from different cities and have traveled internationally to win world championships. Digital gaming is a $20 billion industry in the United States, and team leader Stephanie Harvey of Montreal says for players, it works like any sport.
I practice, I have a team, I have coaches, I have a staff, I have sponsors, I have leagues, I have like official matches, I have tournaments, I have fans, just like a pro sport.
The team plays a combat game called Counter-Strike, which has thousands of fans who watch on the website Twitch and see recaps on YouTube. Charges of sexism have rocked the industry, but despite prejudice, women hold their own in this male-dominated sport, says Bonnie Ruberg, a game researcher at the University of Southern California.
And so when they hit a moment where there's discrimination, somebody says something about them or about women, they know how to stick up for themselves in that environment.
Benita Novshadian studies computers at a California college when she is not competing on them.
Well, right now I'm majoring in information systems, which is basically IT. And I really hope to stick within the gaming industry, and maybe my degree can obviously back that up.
In the meantime, she and her teammates are enjoying online fame and the fun of professional gaming. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition. We welcome your questions or comments. You can send us a tweet on Twitter. Our handle is at @VOA_IE. You can also log on to our webpage, that's voanews.com, for more on the stories you've heard, as well as the rest of today's news. Tracy Carter directed our program. Aydin Erkut was our engineer. Join Jim Stevenson Friday for another International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A little more than 4 years ago, the first ripples of unrest in Tunisia signaled an end to the despotic regime of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and a shift toward democratization of Tunisian society. But what the Tunisian people inherited from the previous regime was a state apparatus crippled by hollowed-out institutions, rife with corruption, and security forces meant to protect the status quo to the detriment of the people. Nonetheless, despite numerous challenges, including an increasing rift between political movements, sporadic civil unrest, and increasing violence, Tunisia slowly and steadily progressed toward democracy. It dismantled the police state, forced opposing political parties to make compromises, held two open and free elections, and last year adopted a progressive constitution. Much of this progress can be credited to Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet, a group of four organizations: the Tunisian General Labor Union, the Tunisian Confederation of Industry, Trade, and Handicrafts, the Tunisian Human Rights League, and the Tunisian Order of Lawyers. The group helped stabilize the fracturing country by drafting an agreement of compromises that served as a roadmap to negotiations and insisting that all parties who wanted to participate in political negotiations must sign the document. 21 parties signed the document, allowing a national dialogue to commence. The Tunisian model of inclusivity and respecting fundamental freedoms of all its citizens is the best answer to the violence and extremist ideologies that have torn apart other countries in the region, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. For its decisive contribution to the building of a pluralistic democracy in Tunisia, the National Dialogue Quartet won the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize. The United States congratulates Tunisia's National Dialogue Quartet on this well-deserved award. This extraordinary honor recognizes the critical role civil society organizations played following the Tunisian Revolution by preserving national unity and constructing a political process that led to both the Constitution and free and fair national elections, said Secretary of State Kerry. Their inspiring achievement is a shining example for all societies that are working toward an inclusive transition from dictatorship to democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.